is Thursday, June 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the summit between President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin takes place next month in Finland. A newcomer causes a political earthquake in New York City.
She essentially knocks off one of the most powerful Democrats, not just in New York State, but in the entire country.
And opposition mounts in France over future concerts by a controversial rapper at a site involved in the 2015 Paris terror attacks. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin will hold their first formal summit July 16th in Helsinki. Confirmation by both sides came a day after Trump's national security advisor John Bolton met with top Russian officials, including Putin, to lay the groundwork for the summit.
Well, I think both President Trump and President Putin feel that it's important for these two leaders of these two critically important countries to get together and discuss their mutual problems and areas of cooperation. It's something that I think both feel will contribute to improvements in the U.S.-Russia bilateral relationship and in stability around the world. I don't think it's anything unusual for President Trump and President Putin to meet. If you just look at meetings in the past year, the leaders of the United Kingdom, Germany, France, Greece, Finland, Austria, Belgium, and Italy have all had bilateral meetings with President Putin. So just taking Europe as an example, many, many leaders of Europe have met with President Putin in this kind of context. And I think President Trump felt and President Putin agreed that now is the time for the two of them to get together.
Putin told Bolton bilateral ties were not in the best shape, but added the White House advisor's visit gives him hope for an improvement. Russia is under international sanctions over its annexation of Crimea in 2014. It has been linked to pro-Russian separatists in Ukraine and criticized for its backing of the Syrian regime. The Kremlin has also been accused of trying to influence U.S. elections, a charge it has denied. Atlantic Council senior fellow Robert Manning tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Syria, Ukraine, and arms control are among the main reasons such a meeting is important.
Putin's a world leader of a significant country with nuclear weapons. The president's right to deal with them. I think we have real problems in terms of the unraveling of our strategic framework with Russia that we've had since the Cold War, and that's something that needs to be seriously examined and fixed. I think there's a possibility of what happens after START expires. I think there's a possibility for a new START, and I wouldn't be shocked if people start talking about going down to 2,000 warheads each. I think that's something that's probably in both countries' interest.
Could a summit irritate U.S. allies in Europe?
Oh, of course. At the moment, a lot of people in NATO are terrified that Trump's behavior at the NATO summit next month will be similar to what he did at the G7. So, yes, of course. But on the other hand, he may pull a deal out of the hat. We don't know. But I think it's unfair to criticize him for a meeting with Putin. A lot of people have, because if you're the president of the United States, I don't think you have a choice but to deal with someone they've defined as a strategic competitor, if not an adversary.
Can there be some movement on issues like Syria and Ukraine?
I think that's the rationale for the summit, frankly. I think Putin so far has been willing to accept Ukraine as another frozen conflict. I think there's efforts afoot to try to find a way back to the Minsk agreement and to find a solution to the Ukrainian issue. And in Syria, similarly, I mean, that's really the worst humanitarian tragedy of this century. And I think, you know, Russia has acted when, if you go back, the Obama administration refused to act, and this is one of the consequences. And it's always easier to get into an intervention than to get out of it. And I think probably Putin's looking for an exit strategy in Syria as well. So I think that's got to be a central issue in the summit.
What do you think the best case scenario would be for what emerges from this summit?
The best case scenario would be some progress on Ukraine that would lead us on a path towards a resolution, and some progress in Syria, and holding the line in terms of current arms control agreements that don't unravel. I think it's a potentially dangerous situation.
Robert Manning of the Atlantic Council. The two countries have agreed to a series of arms control agreements. The most current, New START, which limits the number of warheads, delivery systems, and launchers each country can have, is set to expire in 2021. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Ethiopia and Eritrean leaders will meet for the first time in nearly two decades. China says its trade practices are beneficial to the world. The American envoy to the United Nations says the U.S. is increasing its efforts to get Pakistan to stop harboring terrorists. And European Union leaders consider new migration reforms. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists in Australia and Turkey have found that grease is the word when describing the amount of unique carbon molecules found throughout the Milky Way. Writing in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, researchers created a material in a lab that had the same properties of interstellar dust in order to estimate the amount of space grease in the galaxy. The researchers say they really don't know how many carbon molecules exist between the stars, but they do think that about half the amount is in its pure form, while the remainder can be found in two chemically bound forms, aliphatic, which is described as grease-like, and aromatic, which is mothball-like in nature. The Australian-Turkish team found that there are 10 billion trillion metric tons of the greasy aliphatic carbon molecules in the Milky Way, which they say is equivalent to 40 trillion 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 packs of butter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, do parents know what children are doing on their electronic devices? We'll have a report. A senior UN official is calling for an immediate end to the fighting in Dara and Quneitra in southwest Syria as tens of thousands of civilians flee for their lives. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Senior advisor of the Special Envoy for Syria, Jan Egeland, is mainly appealing to Russia, the United States, and Jordan to use their influence to put an end to the fighting, which erupted 10 days ago. Last year, those countries helped persuade the Syrian government and rebels to create a so-called de-escalation zone in Dara and Quneitra provinces along the Jordanian border. As a consequence, Egeland says, the zone has been a rare area of sanity and protection for hundreds of thousands of civilians in a country that has been at war for 7 years.
There is no protection. There is only war. We cannot have the war coming to an area with 750,000 civilians. Those are now increasingly fleeing for their lives. Many are already internally displaced.
To add to the misery of that beleaguered population, Egeland says the cross-border humanitarian operation from Jordan into southwest Syria, which has proven to be an extremely effective lifeline, was discontinued Tuesday because of the fighting.
Humanitarian actors have pre-positioned supplies inside Dara and inside Quneitra. However, movement is very difficult, and humanitarian operations are paralyzed in too many areas.
Egeland says as soon as the UN receives assurances of safety from the armed groups, the convoys will start rolling again. The UN says some 50,000 people have been displaced by the fighting, though Egeland notes local authorities put that figure at about 70,000. He says there are no estimates on the number of dead and injured, although it's likely to be high because civilians are exposed to the fighting. He says five medical facilities have been hit and are out of commission. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
New York City political circles are still in shock following a stunning Democratic Party primary election upset. This week, 28-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez defeated longtime New York Congressman Joe Crowley to win the party's Democratic nomination. New York's 14th congressional district includes parts of Queens and the Bronx. Ocasio-Cortez is a Latina. Her mother is from Puerto Rico. Christina Greer is associate professor of politics at Fordham University in New York City. She's the author of the book Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. She spoke with me about why the primary result is so striking.
I have yet to meet a single political pundit who thought that this was going to be a reality. I mean, this is someone who's 28 years old with zero political electoral experience. I should be clear. She definitely has political experience, but has never held electoral office. And she essentially knocks off one of the most powerful Democrats, not just in New York State, but in the entire country. I mean, this is someone who had his sights on Nancy Pelosi's speaker seat. Hence, he still had money in the bank and didn't use all of his money to go against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I mean, he didn't show up for debates. He essentially treated her as though she wasn't a real threat. I mean, one would ask, you know, after 14 years of running completely unopposed, he probably did not see her as the threat that she is. And she went door to door and really had a retail politics and an understanding of her district in a way that Crowley's district has changed dramatically since he was first elected. And I think that his time in D.C. and his time away from the district and really the needs and wants and desires of his constituents was ultimately his downfall and definitely his weakness.
How has the district changed since Crowley was first elected?
Well, when Crowley was first elected, the vast majority of the people who were showing up in these very low turnout elections, you know, much more white electorate, and the district has become, now it's 50% Latinx, and so for quite some time, the district's becoming a lot more ethnically and racially diverse, but not necessarily at the polls. Well, this year we saw that not only has the district gotten more diverse ethnically, racially, and class-wise, but that some of these newcomers and some of these people who have been in the district and have never participated in a primary actually came out and participated because they were inspired to do so by someone who said, should we be represented by someone who spends the vast majority of his time in Washington, D.C.? Should we be represented by someone who has outside money and outside interests? You know, what about us? Things are changing in this world. Things are definitely changing in New York and in our district. But are we really benefiting from this change? And I think a lot of people looked around and saw their circumstances and had to ask themselves, I keep voting for the same person over and over again, or I don't vote in a primary, which in New York, in many ways, the primary is the big general election, right? Because so many people run unopposed in November. And I think that they really looked at themselves in the era of the Trump administration and said, you know what? Why not? You know, like, why not take a chance on something new? And there are enough people who clearly felt that way, where Cortez not only beat Crowley, I mean, this isn't a runoff, this isn't a conversation, this was a decisive victory by the district.
Ocasio-Cortez ran as a Democratic socialist. Does this indicate that Democratic politics are veering more to the left?
I don't necessarily know that the Democratic politics are veering to the left. I think what it does is expose the fact that we have a divide within the party that we've had for quite some time that we never resolved after 2016, when we had sort of the Bernie progressive wing of the party and the Hillary Clinton more moderate centrist wing of the party. And when Hillary Clinton was victorious after the primary, many people just sort of let it go, and that was the path that the Democrats were on. But as you saw, as far as turnout in a lot of places across the country, there are a lot of Democrats who, you know, identify as progressives, and they're really disappointed and disillusioned with the direction of the Democratic Party. And so this is, you know, some people call it a civil war. Some people call it a deep divide. Some people just say, well, maybe we need to have a moment of reckoning similar to what the Republicans did after the 2008 election and really sit down and reassess who we are as a party, especially in the age of Trump. And we have not defined that. And so because of that, you have districts where some people are saying, I want a progressive politician to represent me in Washington, D.C. I don't want a moderate. I want someone who is going to say abolish ICE. I do want someone who's going to talk about, you know, a minimum wage that's mandatory $15. You know, and so these very sort of bold progressive ideas. That is not every Democrat. And so as we try and figure out our policy positions, who we are as a party, there's some real divisions that these races illustrated. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was definitely victorious, but we saw you know, in Carolyn Maloney's district and in Yvette Clark's district, even though they were victorious, both of their challengers, both under 35 years old, both define themselves as progressives, both of them got well over 40%.
Christina Greer, Associate Professor of Politics at Fordham University in New York City. With parents often playing catch-up with the fast pace of technology, it's often difficult to really know what their children are doing on their electronic devices. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
What about Jasmine?
Despite monitoring apps and restrictions placed on phones, parents are finding it hard to keep up with their kids. Jania Bivens has a 13-year-old daughter, Ariel.
You can't be everywhere all the time.
Bivens says the technology designed to keep children safe online is not infallible because after she blocked Twitter on her daughter's phone, the 13-year-old found another way and got a message from a stranger.
This guy asked to see my feet, and I was like, what?
When you give your child this ominous device, it's like giving them the keys to your brand new Cadillac.
Richard Wistoki is a retired police detective who specializes in cyber crimes. He says parents trust their children too much and are victims of what he calls the NMK syndrome.
Not my kid. My kid would never do that.
Yet young children can now chat with strangers on apps like WhatsApp, House Party, and Musical.ly. One parent had no idea her 13-year-old daughter was messaging with an unknown boy on Snapchat until an older daughter alerted her.
As parents, we need to wake up. No doubt.
Nathan Hale Elementary School principal Don Iles Gomez says her school requires students to leave their phones in the homeroom throughout the day.
I cannot even imagine how much is going on that we have no clue. And I'm saying that as someone who works with kids and is decent with technology.
But even being decent with technology isn't enough. Experts say kids find all kinds of sneaky ways of using their phones right under their parents' noses.
Why does it come up like that?
And as one mother put it, just monitoring their social media presence is a full-time job in addition to the day-to-day parenting.
Who's that?
Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Controversial French rapper Medine is scheduled to take the stage later this year at the Bataclan Concert Hall in Paris, where 89 people were killed during terror attacks in 2015. As Lisa Bryant reports from Paris, not everyone is happy about the coming shows, which have caused a furor, triggering a debate over law and order and freedom of expression.
Tout ce que je voulais faire, c'était le Bataclan.
All I want to do is the Bataclan, the Bataclan. Those are the lyrics to a song released earlier this year by rapper Medine. Two of his concerts are scheduled for the Bataclan in October, but not everyone wants to see the shows go on.
Dieu est mort, selon Nietzsche. Nietzsche est mort, signé Dieu. On parlera laïcité entre la I de la Saint-Mathieu. Nous sommes les gens du livre.
At issue in part are the words to another song by the artist whose real name is Medine Zawish. In the song Don't Like, one of the lyrics says, I put fatwas on the heads of idiots. The song was released in 2015, the same year that France was hit by several terrorist attacks, including one targeting the Bataclan. This is not the first time Medine has generated controversy. A decade earlier, he released an album titled Jihad, and he has been photographed in a t-shirt bearing the term and a massive sword. Now thousands of people have signed a petition launched by the far right and demanding Medine's concerts be canceled. Critics are tweeting their opposition via the hashtag Pas de Medine au Bataclan, or No Medine at the Bataclan.
Oui, oui, il l'accompagne, il le défend même quand il est mis en cause. Je vous rappelle qu'il y a quelques jours, Medine...
On French radio, far-right National Rally Party head Marine Le Pen described Medine as an Islamic fundamentalist. His performance at the Bataclan, she says, is a threat to public order.
Nous avons pris contact avec la direction de la salle du Bataclan pour comprendre...
Victims associations are divided. Philippe Duperron, who heads one of them, is against the concerts taking place out of respect for the victims and the memory of them. Medine and his lawyers are fighting back. The rapper has criticized Islamic fundamentalism a number of times and says he is against violence. He says Don't Like is more of a slap at France's tough secular creed and that the jihad he refers to is an internal spiritual struggle rather than violence. It's been 15 years since I've criticized all forms of radicalism in my albums, he posted recently on social media. Banning his concerts, he argues, amounts to caving in to the far right. Medine's arguments are drawing support, partly in the name of free expression. That appears to be the argument of Prime Minister Edouard Philippe. Still others argued the divisions over the rapper's concerts are the worst outcome at a time when the French should be united against terrorism. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
That is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. recognizes the desperate needs of the persecuted religious and ethnic communities of the Middle East and is sending immediate help. The U.S. will not rest until these oppressed people receive the help they need to thrive again, wrote U.S. Agency for International Development Administrator Mark Green in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has been tasked with providing more effective and direct support to persecuted religious and ethnic minorities, including Christians and Yazidis. To this end, Administrator Green announced that USAID had redirected more than $60 million in humanitarian and stabilization assistance to provide infrastructure support and life-saving aid in northern Iraq. The money, said Administrator Green, has helped rebuild schools, hospitals, power stations, and wells, and ease the transition of those returning home. However, in too many instances, the aid has taken too long to arrive. Many of the communities with the greatest need have yet to be reached. To overcome bureaucratic and other obstacles, USAID is now redoubling its efforts to distribute the aid Iraq's persecuted religious communities desperately need. Every delay brings these religious communities one day closer to extinction. In Iraq, nearly 90% of Christians have fled in the past 15 years, emptying entire villages that had stood for more than 1,000 years. The Yazidi population has been similarly decimated. The time to act is now, declared Administrator Green. Christians, Yazidis, and other persecuted religious communities in the Middle East have suffered unspeakable harm for too long. Their plight has touched the hearts of the American people and stirred this nation to step up with compassion and conviction. The ancient faith communities in Iraq and across the Middle East are counting on us, said Administrator Green. We will not let them down.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.